So yeah, well, I'm going to turn it over to you, Stephen. Remind everybody, 11:30 to 1, we go into cannabis. And tomorrow, we have the meetups, at 10:30 to catalyze more of these events. So, without further ado.
Thanks, Mark. Trying to get this squarely here. Okay. So who wins the restart is the question we've been trying to figure out for some time. I just want to start with a comment that Janet Yellen did a presentation back in 2016, and it was entitled Macroeconomic Research After the Crisis. She was not referring to COVID. She was referring to the financial crisis. And she asked her committee members at the FOMC, is it possible to temporarily run an economy at a very high pressure, which is an experiment we're trying right now, it seems, with the latest stimulus. She also commented at that time in that speech that there are limits in economists' understanding of the economy, which was interesting to hear from her because, not many economists think they don't have the answers. And then lastly, she asked one of the questions that she was asking the FOMC is, what is inflation? And that's a funny question to think about coming from the FOMC, but when you think about it, the way the world's changed, it's a fundamental issue, and it's one that we're going to be grappling with going forward because the measures of inflation and the measures of GDP and productivity don't necessarily reflect the advances that are being made. So we've now thrown 55% of U.S. GDP at the last crisis with COVID. So we're in a situation now where we have to figure out where do we go from here. And there's a lot of tension right now on is the economy overheating or not. The Feds maintain that they believe that everything's transitory. So I think the battle lines are being drawn around the topics for investors of which countries win, which asset classes win, sectors, style, policymakers versus the bond market vigilantes, which that last one is another way of saying, does inflation beat productivity? Or does productivity beat inflation right now? And the bet from the Fed and many others is that productivity will win out in this environment. I wanted to just take a step back and remind people that a year ago we were talking about a pandemic where we had a shutdown that was viewed as a temporary shutdown for health reasons rather than economic reasons, which is different than a typical recession where you have demand slow and you end up with a situation where you have to actually build confidence back up. So the temporary nature of this is one that we're all grappling with. The other is that we don't typically get in a typical recession massive pent-up demand. We have that right now, and it's from three sources: consumers, corporations, and governments. So that's a big issue that's a very different in coming out of this. And the last is the different inflation dynamics. COVID caused both supply and demand to decline. Where in a typical recession, it's a decline in demand that then you have demand slowly catching up to supply, which leads to disinflationary pressures. And we're doing this in an environment with, as I mentioned, policy support being unprecedented, not just here, when you think about around the world, where it, 35% or more of GDP has been thrown at the problem. And in Japan, it's 74%. And you only see 18 or so percent in China. So I wanted to take a look at the world both last year and what the outlook is going forward. So the top is 2020 GDP for the world, the advanced economies, and the emerging economies. And what's fascinating about this chart, if you think back 20 years, how far the emerging economies have come, and now they're 41% of global GDP last year, and that wasn't a great year. So you now see if you go to the bottom, you look at the GDP changes for 21 and 22, 21 in the dark blue, 22 in the light blue. And for the world, pretty healthy returns this year at 5.5%. We're down about 3.3% last year, according to the IMF. Advanced economies growing nicely this year and next, and the emerging economies with strong growth. But I would actually caution in both the advanced and emerging markets, we're expecting a very uneven environment that we're going to be working with. So I wanted to step back and look at the top 10 economies for perspective and to kind of measure the changes that are going on. And I did this in U.S. dollars because it's easier for me to do the changes on and keep consistent in my own head. But the U.S. in dollars at just about 21 trillion, China really moving it up at just under 15, followed by Japan and go down the list. And actually that Japan number I think is wrong, so I apologize for that. But when you go down the list, it gets very, very close. And in the back end, Russia and Brazil keep flip-flopping. But when you go down below and you look at the growth rates projected for next year, for this year and next, you're seeing very strong growth out of the U.S. and China, strong growth out of India, and pretty good growth out of places like France and Canada, where you see some changes. But I think there's a lot going on, and you have to really be very country-specific, very company-specific as well to think about how you're looking at the dynamics. So I wanted to just step back and look at the growth projections from some of the different companies out on the street. And this is for U.S. growth. And, you know, Goldman's at 7.7. Cornerstone, I think, is actually moving up between 8 and 9% right now. That's Nancy Lazar. Jefferies at 7. You're looking at really bigger growth rates than the IMF's projecting. And these numbers, the IMF was really at the end of last year, beginning of this year. And we're already seeing the vaccines really taking off, and that's encouraging people to raise their growth estimates as we try and return to normal. So who do we think wins? I'm going to give this as quickly and simply as I can. I think the U.S. and China continue to lead, but for very different reasons. The U.S. for the massive stimulus that they had, China because they were in this earlier, came out of it much quicker than everyone else. And they're two of the most dynamic economies in the world today. I think there are other pockets of countries that win, but I think regionally, Europe has some challenges. I think the many of the emerging market economies, particularly the highly indebted ones, will continue to struggle, and particularly as U.S. rates push up, that puts additional pressures on them. So I think you have to be very selective on a country basis, and I do think there are opportunities to find in Europe and in Asia where you can see besides the U.S. and China, great opportunities, but you have to be very careful and selective. On an asset class basis, I think it used to be there are no other alternatives. As rates move up, you are starting to have other alternatives, but we don't think they're great yet. So we continue to focus on equities, private credit, emerging market equities, but again, be very selective there. Cash, I think Bitcoin and gold are interesting in that their dynamics look like they should trend positively on the upside, particularly Bitcoin. But gold has some different dynamics, particularly the emergence of Bitcoin, and it hasn't been behaving quite as well as people would hope with rising rate expectations and inflation expectations. But we still think there are good opportunities in both those areas. And lastly, we don't think this is a time to be owning bonds. You could be tactically looking at a reversal in the move up in rates, but we don't think it's going to be significant enough to make it a big winning investment. And I think if anyone had a chance to see what Bridgewater put out yesterday, their view of investing in bonds is not very positive right now, with returns taking anywhere between 40 years and a couple hundred years to get good returns on your money. So we continue to be shy away from that. In the sectors, we still are very positive on the new economy sectors. We think tech is still undervalued and underrepresented, not just for what it does for the tech sector, but what it does for every sector. We think housing has a ways to go still in the U.S., even though it's been a very hot area and it's getting concerning, but we still think the rate environment is a very positive one for that. 3.25 mortgage rates are not deal breakers. We think manufacturing in the U.S. continues to do well, which means we have a positive view on cyclicality in the near term. And then looking at innovative retailers, there are a big divergence between the haves and have-nots in coming out of the COVID crisis in retailing. And then lastly, healthcare, we think, continues to do well. Virus-impacted sectors have already experienced a big rebound. We think they'll have some further rebound, but then it gets very difficult to make money on. So a lot of the people on this call, and Mark, when you go back to the what people did well last year, there were many who got in early on energy and some of the other damaged sectors. But they're at a difficult spot now when even some of the leisure companies are saying they're 2 years out before they'll return to where they were. So we think that when you look at this, their success will depend on other factors, particularly how they cut costs. The leisure area is going through some massive restructuring of their employment base, and they're looking for technology to play a bigger role. I know one of the leading travel companies went from somewhere around 15,000 agents down to around 2,500 agents right now. I doubt when we return to a full reopening that they will achieve close to where they were pre-COVID. They're going to use technology to drive the way. When we get to style, I think growth has led for some time and should continue to do well. These growth numbers that we're looking at that I just showed you are not sustainable high growth numbers. So companies that can grow at an above market rate should continue to be well rewarded. What won't be well rewarded in the growth space is the hyper growth names that performed exceptionally well last year. And it's an area we think you have to be very cautious in playing. We think select value names should do well. But we're not fully in the rotate to value camp. We think there's a lot of value traps and a lot of highly indebted companies with bad growth rates and a very difficult opportunity to convert their business to a more of a new economy setup will be a challenge for many of them. So the problem areas for us include the expended PE COVID beneficiaries. At ARS, we've actually eliminated those holdings from our portfolio earlier this year. We're also very concerned about heavily indebted companies with higher interest rates, putting greater pressure on. I would carry that over to heavily indebted economies as well. We think low growth value companies are going to be caught in a bad spot, so we would be very cautious there. We think small caps and PE and private credit can do well in this environment, and we still think there are some nice opportunities there, particularly as consumers get back to doing what they do. And then we think the cyclical assets should continue their recovery, but again, you have to be very cautious. When it comes to the who wins, the policymakers or the bond market vigilantes, I think the jury's still out. We believe that inflation is going to be transitory, but we are also a little surprised that the $1.9 trillion got put through. And what we have to see is what that means for additional spending on infrastructure. But there have been near-term higher pressures than we were anticipating, but we still believe that they will be transitory and that a lot of the money being spent will be spent on increasing productivity because it's going to be necessary for companies to stay in business. But also, we think that the Republican Party will start to push back on the spending that's going on, and that could limit the move up in rates. We think that you could see 2% or higher rates, but we don't think that's a deal breaker for equities or for the markets or for the economy. So we think that there are a lot of opportunities to make money, but this is a time to be selective and to be opportunistic in our view. So Mark, with that, I'll stop and like to hear other people's views on what wins in this environment.
That's great. Thank you, Stephen.
There's been a lot of chatter recently about taxes. Yeah. What do you see the impact of that relative to, you know, on a macro, the overall stock market, on a kind of a stock selection, asset selection basis?
I think the initial thrust is realistically going to come down to, the initial thing, and Yellen's talking about this with other countries today, is, the minimum tax for foreign, earnings so that you can't dodge around. So a global kind of minimum tax rate. I think that's going to be one of the early efforts they're going to make, and then that'll be followed by closing loopholes first. Jack Lew is on CNBC this morning talking about that. They think there's easy money there. I don't think Janet Yellen or Jay Powell would think this is an ideal time to raise taxes. I think they'll be more of a low-hanging fruit kind of phase-in approach to taxes. But I think it's a real risk to slow down the economy at a time that we don't need to slow down. We need more healing, and we have big bills coming due. So it's a real dilemma for them, which is where I think the pushback from the Republicans has to come to kind of moderate where we go from here. But I also think that you can look at companies, Jim, and I'll pick on one that I'm not current on their tax rate, but a couple years ago, IBM was, I think, had an effective tax rate of 4%. I think it moved up into the teens last year. And that's what they're going to target first and foremost. And then we go from there. But I don't think there's a lot of room to raise the corporate tax to the level that they're suggesting of 28% anytime soon. I do think they'll take a shot at higher individual taxes for the top brackets. But, you know, the irony there is you can raise the top rate on billionaires to 39%, but they're still not going to pay anything close to that. So I think that they're going to focus on how they can limit the leakage that is in the system first. But I think it's going to be a big issue that's going to be where the Republicans really put their stake in the ground and try and debate it. I also think it's where some of the moderate Democrats will step up and make things more focused and try and avoid those areas.
There's also been chatter, right, on long-term capital gains tax rates. And clearly, you know, what, you know, as I sit and think about, does that push you into thinking about, you know, dividend paying stocks versus growth stocks? Or I don't know if you've thought about it at that level.
Well, they've actually talked about raising the rate for, you know, if they raise the top tax bracket, it takes your dividend income for higher income earners up too. So we looked at both. I think the in a low rate environment, the higher rates that you can get by owning some of the equities is so much higher than what you would get from owning a quality bond that I don't think that change in the tax is going to be enough to push you away from that.
Other comments, questions?
Hey, Steve, it's Rob here. Do you have any quick insight on large financial institutions and asset managers with respect to forbearance? There's some talk about them being reducing the forbearance in terms of principal and interest and, you know, becoming more sort of accountable to their shareholders. Do you have any updated thoughts there?
I absolutely do not. If anyone else in the call has something there, I can't help you, Rob.
That's fine. Thank you.
You know, Chris Brown over at Allstate has been talking about that for a bit. You may want to talk to them. Actually, I'm trying to bring on, it's a Denison guy who runs a $19 billion debt book. We talked about that, Joe. I can't remember his name.
I remember having that exchange with Chris. That was good. Actually, I could pivot it completely here. Steve,
you could pivot like the whole day.
I learned from you. If you talked about this earlier in your presentation, forgive me, but the move for 18 and above in the U.S. for being eligible, what, May 1st, does that have do you have a read on confidence for the, on that?
I mean, I have four kids in my house who are in their 20s. If they're out anymore, it would be, you know, and they'll be out. They go out at earlier now than they did before. So I think the change will be they'll stay out later. But I do think it does open up the economy more and creates more spending. And one of the big parts is as we get the vaccines going, and we all know is there are a lot of women in particular that are unable to go back to work because of the challenges with their kids. So anything we can do to get it down even lower is going to be helpful. So I think it's just a question of this, the rate of change in three areas, one, interest rates and inflation, and two, the rate of vaccination are the things that are going to really drive how we see things. And I would say that I think the big surprise for me this year was just how sharp the move up in interest rates was, how quickly we got a 60 basis point move. And those rate of change issues in a very low interest rate environment are, you have not only a percentage increase from a, you know, 90 basis points to 160, but you also have the speed of the move. And I think that's unnerved the market a little bit and has it unsettled. I think we're going to see a settling of interest rates, the dollar and inflation, and it will move up in a more graduated approach. And then the markets can act more normally. And that allows for everything to kind of ease in how we're looking at the reopening. So I think those are going to be the rate of changes to me, the one you want to watch from this point forward on those three areas.
Stephen, what is a more normal market? What does that mean?
I would say it's
definitions, but I would love your definition.
Well, I think a more normal market is when there are alternatives to the assets that are being pushed up in this environment. I mean, having a capital market system that's flowing appropriately with reasonable rates of return on it is one. We have to move out of a negative interest rate environment globally. The effects of that long term are going to be problematic, but we can't move up too much because the debt burdens are too high. So that may normal may look more like Japan than it does what we thought of. Right. But I think getting rates up is going to be important. But get them up in a step function, not a spike function like we've had so far. And that'll allow the capital markets to work better. It'll allow less volatility in the world and less shocks if we do it right. But that's a big if.
Yeah, it's interesting. With the rise in rates here, it's also pulled up like Swiss bonds and German bonds. The Swiss curve is still all negative, which to me is still startling. Yeah. Apparently, German bonds are now positive from 22 years out. They're like flat to about 14 years and then still negative. But yeah, it's interesting because now, you know, you're starting to get some optionality, you know, with regard to the short-term, you know, cash and instruments there.
The problem, though, is as the rates get more attractive, if they keep going up, you lose your value. So it's not a great scenario for people. But there are big institutions and pensions and insurance companies and then around the world savers that need higher rates because they don't have income necessarily on the savings side that they can afford it. So I think that is an issue. Ironically, Bill, one of the challenges to getting higher rates is the yield differential you just talked about. The U.S. and Germany are almost 2% in yield differential right now. Mm-hmm. So that's still too big a swing. And I would say the other thing is rates move up, it puts even more pressure on the many of the emerging market nations. And that has some real issues for them, too, that creates even greater strains. Particularly
yeah.
to their lenders. So
yeah, it's interesting when you factor the dollar play in there as well. You know, the fact that it's depreciated has been positive for emerging. You know, but now, you know, we've seen a little rebound. I think it's just a counter trend rally. You know, but the dollar's eased off. So yeah, the difference between kind of the currency effect and interest rates. I saw it sort of pivoting just a little bit. I saw that both China and Japan were big buyers in the last auction, which I thought was interesting. And yeah. Also, you know, that will help kind of take a little bit of the steam off the rates. Do you have any further thoughts on that? But, you know, again, I thought it was very positive that, you know, strong buying interest there.
Yeah, I think you touched on it. The dollar change actually has been very helpful in terms of taking some of the pressure off the U.S. economy and the U.S. market. But it has reversed the pressure onto others. And Japan is one of the areas where you're actually starting to see a bit of a switch, Bill, into them having to come back to the U.S. So I do think that is interesting. So we're in the view that the dollar will consolidate, if not gain some more strength in the near term, and longer term, it still looks like one of the strongest currencies out there. So we're mm-hmm. still positive in that on the U.S. and for that reason.
Yeah. Just kind of a side note, it'll be interesting to see, you know, if rates kind of remain up a little bit, the discount that has a very positive impact on the discounting of liabilities for pension plans. And even though in the corporate space, you know, those are DB plans are far and few between now, but still on public plans, it's still a huge pile of money, you know, there. And that's going to help take some of the pressure off, you know, them, a little bit, but it's an interesting dynamic.
I'll throw in one last thing, Mark, before we run. And that is that, there is a proposal in India to ban cryptocurrencies and the use of them to push people into what they're planning on developing their own. And it's not just owning them, but it's mining for them. It's the whole gamut. So I thought that was going to be something for the Bitcoin owners to keep an eye on because it is a proposed law right now in India. So if anyone around the world are following it, has any insight into that.
I have an aunt who works at the RBI. I'm going to message her about that and what the RBI's positioning is on that.
Yeah, because if that starts something, that could actually have, you know, the 50,000 was, I saw estimates going to 75,000, but if that goes through, it could go the other way pretty quickly.
I wonder how they're going to actually do that, considering there's no KYC on Bitcoin. You just buy it anonymously through a hash. So,
I'm sure you can do one. Or not. I saw that the UK is also running a test with two unnamed internet companies and two of the police agencies there to track where they can try and track all your web browsing. So I think, Jonah, they're moving into a mode where surveillance is going to pick up around the world. And I don't know that you can beat everything.
No, it's definitely interesting. I will tell you that when people there's a new term called a Bitcoin maximalist. I will tell you I'm not a Bitcoin maximalist, but I will tell you that when people resist Bitcoin, the price tends to go up because people who already hold Bitcoin believe they should buy more when people resist.